Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. Today is Wednesday, February 15th, 2012. This is Ben Stone. Before I get too far into what we're going to do today, let me just give an explanation of what happened partially over the weekend and the first part of the week. Sometime around late Saturday or early Sunday, the hosting company that hosts our website, BadQuaker.com, figured out that there was vulnerabilities in the software that they ran that they run to host the websites. So they very wisely began updating their software as quickly as they could in order to protect their customers. What that meant was, over the course of Sunday, there were large gaps of time when BadQuaker.com was not available. And if you tried to go over to BadQuaker.com, you probably got a notification that it was not available or that it was down or whatever. Monday, on and off, we faced the same difficulties. It appears that they were updating part of their site at the exact same time frame that we were updating our files. So some people actually got to hear the podcast that published on Monday morning before it vanished into the cyber nothingness. I believe iTunes actually got a copy of it, but I'm not sure if they got a full copy or just a polluted copy. But either way, so Tuesday, once everything was stabilized, we went ahead and reloaded the podcast and sent it back out again, rather than having a gap where some people missed that podcast. It was what I believe to be a fairly critical podcast about informal value transfer. And if you haven't had a chance to listen to that podcast, I believe it's well worth it. I believe it's important. I've kind of been building up to try to get the opportunity to have that podcast. So if you haven't heard the podcast that was originally sent out Monday and then we sent it back out Tuesday again, get over to BadQuaker.com and download that and give it a listen. It also contains an explanation of some mistakes I made on an earlier podcast as well, and a little bit of nonsensical history with me rambling on about history, because that's what history geeks do. So today's podcast, on the other hand, is going to be a replay of a podcast of an interview from last year. And the reason that I'm doing this, I've been referring to it now for a couple of weeks. It's the interview with Alan. And the reason why is because it falls so well in line with the series that I've been doing on the inevitability of the police state. Also, I've got a couple of guests that I'm hoping to bring on the podcast in the near future, and at least one of those guests is going to speak specifically on this topic. And so I think it's important to bring back up this interview with Alan so that you get to hear a personal story of a guy who was going along just a regular teenager in high school, doing all the right things, you know, leader of the team in the football, leader of the wrestling team, on the honor roll, getting great grades, on his way towards a college education, and one stupid little mistake and he's in their system, and now he can't get out, and years go by and he just can't get out of the system. And so give this a listen. If you've already listened to it before, you know, it's been a long time. Maybe hear it again and you'll see exactly what it is that I've been talking about for a few weeks here. But what went on with Alan is just heart-wrenching. I watched this happen from afar because, like is mentioned in the interview, I've known Alan for something like 33, 34 years now. So I watched this from afar, and it was just heartbreaking to see it happen, to see someone with so much potential, and to see him have to struggle this hard just to keep even. Not, you know, a guy that normally would excel, and it had excelled in everything that he had done, and yet the burden of the state is just right on top of him. And if you realize that if you listen to my podcast from the other day on the informal value transfer systems and how the state prevents some people from banking, well, Alan's one of those people. So without any more Here's the interview with Alan from last year, and it's mostly intact. I've trimmed it a little bit because there were some dead awkward spots and some background noise. So I've tinkered with it a little bit to try to clean it up, but I've tried to maintain all the content so that you still get the whole message from it. Folks, thanks very much, and here's the interview. With me today is a friend of mine named Alan, and he is going to explain to you some of the things that he's gone through in his life, and see if we can give you an idea of what's happening all across Middle America, and what's happening, really the same thing's happening in inner cities. It just has a different twist to it, but it's happening all across Middle America. It's happening in Appalachia. It's happening out in the Rockies. It's happening in Texas. It's happening in the Ozarks. It's happening in Louisiana. It's all over the United States, happening to Middle America, and most people have no idea what's going on. Alan, thanks for taking your time and being with me today. What do you do for a living? What's your passions? What do you like to do?
Well, I restore antique cars, build hot rods, choppers, work at a paint and body shop. I'm a sheet metal fabricator, though, by trade, is what my listing is.
Yeah, and then you also do, like, wreck repairs and things like that. That's nice extra money in there.
Right.
Supports the habit, so to speak.
Yeah.
How long you been doing body work?
Oh, about 8 years.
Yeah. I've seen some of your work, and it's pretty impressive.
Thank you.
You go to auto shows pretty regularly and have some successes in that. When did you first start having problems with the what we jokingly refer to as the justice system?
Well, I'd say it was probably about 96. I was roughly a senior in high school, and, you know, made a mistake, and ended up buying a rifle from somebody, and come to find out it was stolen.
Mm-hmm.
So being that I was young, the only choice that I had at that time was to get put on what they call probation.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, they put me on probation. You know, charged me a bunch of money.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember exactly what they charged me.
Right, right.
You know, on top of having to, you know, get an attorney.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
And it's not just one thing. It's like you pay some for this, some for this, some for this. There's layers of things that they charge you. It's not all out in the open.
You know, crime victims compensation was one of them. You know, of course, the court costs.
Right.
Filing fees.
Mm-hmm.
Attorneys had fees.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just, the list was ongoing.
Right.
You know, roughly, I don't know, probably $3,800 worth, you know, for, you know, an 18-year-old that just graduated high school.
Yeah.
I've always had a job
since
I was, you know, 16 and been able to drive. I even had a job before that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I've always had steady income, but it was just a mistake.
Mm-hmm. Now, if purely theorizing, if you'd have been in a situation where your family could have just plopped down $10,000 for a different level of attorney, do you think you would have had the same outcome as what you had?
Oh, no. Definitely not. I mean, it would have been totally different.
Yeah.
Because it happens every day.
Right.
It happens every day. If you've got the right last name, or if you're related to this person or that person that owns this or that, you're basically going to walk on whatever you do.
From that point, now you didn't go to any, you didn't have to spend any time in any kind of incarceration or anything like that at that time?
Not at that point. They did what they did is they gave me a suspended imposition of sentence, which means the felony wouldn't have been on my record if I were to walk 5 years of their probation.
Right.
Which consisted of going and seeing them once a month, submitting to your analysis. Since it was a firearm incident, even after I turned 21, I was unable to drink a beer. You know, even though I had the right to go buy a beer, I couldn't do that because it curtailed the firearm.
Because somehow we're going to make the assumption here that buying a stolen firearm has in some way something to do with alcohol.
Correct.
The
way I look at it is, you know, just like I'm not able to own a firearm to this day.
Yeah.
You know, because I was put on this.
Yeah.
So now it comes down to the, you know, they can keep track of the guns.
Yeah.
You know, more readily if everybody's on probation or parole.
Right. Especially, I just throw this back out again, especially middle America. And I'm talking middle America meaning, I don't know, that's not a very good term because middle America sounds geographic, and it is to a certain extent.
Well, the rural America.
Yeah.
Working class, the, you know, the, not the real big cities, because if this were to happen, and I'm just assuming, but I'm pretty sure it, if this were to happen and I lived in St. Louis, Kansas City, Denver, you know, a big metropolis,
yeah,
I wouldn't have gotten near the punishment.
Mm-hmm. But they're, in a way, I mean, I used this phrase a minute ago when we were talking, but in a way they're milking a different herd. They have a different herd to milk in those cities than they have out here, out in rural America. And so they take advantage of who they have, you know.
Correct.
I mean, I don't mean to insult you by saying, you know, like you're a cow or something. That's not what I mean.
No,
but,
no,
but that's like their view of us in this situation. We're just someone for them to milk, to get a free income from.
Yeah.
I'll kick back to an article I wrote some time back. This is, economists refer to this as rent seeking. It's where you have a sector of the population that feeds off of the productivity of someone else, but they don't add anything to it. They just feed off of the ones that are productive. And in the process of doing that, they actually do more harm in the whole process than what they do good. So like in your case, you got this little thing that could have been handled. It was probably just a matter of confusion. Like you said, it was some mistakes. Mistakes were made, okay, there's ways that it could have been handled, but instead you're looking at a felon's, and by having that blemish on a high school kid's record and then going into an adult life with it, that immediately limits your income and your future earnings abilities. So by them acting in the way they did, not only did they take money from you that they had no right to, they also limited your ability to earn later on and interfered with your whole life, you know, in general.
Right.
And then the goofy idea that somehow a gun is related to alcohol and that you're caught with an illegal gun, therefore you can't have alcohol. It's like, this is like, you were caught with an illegal pencil, therefore you can't have cheese. These things are not related, you know. I don't know how, if someone was here with us who could make the argument that guns and alcohol are related, the first thing I'd think is, do you work for the government? Because I don't know of any normal human beings who think those things are connected.
You know, and another thing is, you know, it's not so much, you know, is a high school kid that got in trouble with this blemish now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that blemish, now that it's happened, it turned my view. Because now, you know, because they come and arrested me at school.
Oh, really?
So here
I didn't know that.
So here I am walking down the halls with my peers.
Yeah.
In handcuffs. So now I'm not just, you know, the kid that got good grades in school and played sports and, you know, was the captain of the football team and the wrestling team and the baseball team and everything that I did.
Yeah.
You know, now I'm walking down the halls at school in handcuffs. So now I'm,
you're stuck with this now. You're the humiliation and everything else that goes with it.
Now the blemish is even worse.
Yeah.
Not so much that, you know, on the job side, but in the psychology side of everything, you know, and at 18, you know, you really don't know what you're going to do.
Yeah.
You've tried to become an adult in the ways you can do, you know, the best of your ability. But, you know, something like that happens, then it takes you on this road. And next thing you know, you're on a different road because of what's happened.
What was the next encounter?
Oh, because of the whole, you know, getting arrested, I graduated high school, got accepted to college, you know, went to college, partied, you know, just typical, you know, what I would say 90% of all college students do.
Right.
And then got 4 years and I'd say about 6 months into my probation.
Real close to the end.
Real close to the end. And got caught drinking.
Mm-hmm.
They did a UA on me, and I was clean for everything except alcohol.
Mm.
So they told me I had to go to substance abuse classes
that were
$45 a week for 16 weeks. I had to do that. In that time, I felt like it was unjust. So they revoked my probation. Instead of being an SIS, it's now an SES. So now I'm a convicted felon with 5 more years probation to start along with it. Just for getting caught drinking.
Yeah.
It's not like I, killed somebody or anything like that. So my 5 years of probation started all over again.
Yeah.
But now as a convicted felon.
So now they've got you in the system. They've got you targeted. Anytime that a cop runs your license plate or anytime that a cop, runs your driver's license or anything, then he's got an instant flag to know that this is, somebody we can continue to live off of.
Right. And I get treated pretty poorly when I get pulled over.
I'll bet.
Because of the firearm and I've got caught drinking. So all these things stacked up. Now I'm just the world's worst guy and I'm on the ground every time I get pulled over.
Yeah. That hits the mind. You mentioned the psyche a minute ago. That hits the mind in a particular way. Knowing that every time you're going to have an encounter, it's going to be all out on their part, total domination, and you have to submit. If you resist in the slightest way, there's a possibility you're dead. I mean, that's got to go through your mind every single encounter.
Yeah.
That if you resist the slightest bit, you might be just a little blip on the news and nobody would even know what happened. It would just...
Well, and that is a possibility, and then the other possibility is if I buck at him it all, then I'm in jail.
Yeah.
Because I am in the system.
Yeah.
Because I view that I have no rights because I've got a number. Everything that I do is under watch.
Yeah.
And you would think they'd have better things to do, but I guess they don't.
Well, it's a money-making process for them. Now, let's talk a little bit about, I keep saying this, that they're making money off of this, and a lot of people don't realize the layers of money-making that takes place in these processes. First off, the judge has his salary, the cop has his salary, the DA has their salary, the defense attorney has their salary, And all the ones that work for the government, not the private attorneys, but all the ones working for the government, they all have their regular salaries. But then in addition to that, their departments and their offices get money, Fed money and state money, for a variety of different things according to, like a local police. If they have a DARE program, then they get more funding. And if their DARE program has a DARE car that they can take out to the high school, they get extra funding. And if they, if they have so many drug busts within a certain time frame, they get extra funding. Plus, they get to keep all the proceeds of all the drug busts. So, like, if somebody has a $20 bill in their wallet, is totally unsuspicious, and you get busted with what they consider to be a marketable amount of drugs, they get to keep your $20. It doesn't matter that that is clearly not drug money. Doesn't matter. And if you're in a car when this happens, they own your car. And there's layers of how these people make money off of this. And so the individual cop or the individual judge, you say, well, he doesn't get a bribe or he doesn't get a kickback. Yeah, but when the budget of his office is bumped up for every single thing he does, in a sense, he is getting a kickback for this, And the same thing happens with each one of these rehab and these programs that they send you through and the counseling and having to go in and constantly be tested for substances. And even the medical industry gets federal and state funding, plus people in the system have to pay too. So there's these layers, and the more activity, the more people they can draw in, then the bigger their budgets and the easier their life is living off of the rest of the taxpayers. Have you seen that type of...
Oh, it's horrible, here and where I live. One of the stipulations of probation or parole is you're not supposed to associate with anybody else that's on probation or parole. Well, in this town, you can't do it.
Yeah.
If you work at a factory,
mm-hmm.
you're going to associate with somebody who's on probation or parole.
Yeah.
If you work in a grocery store,
yeah.
somebody's on probation or parole. I mean, everybody's 90%
mm-hmm.
of, I'd say, the youth. And it's not just nailed down to the youth.
Right.
You know, because it could be the older population, you know, got caught with a DWI, first time ever, you mm-hmm. know. Okay, they're on probation.
Yeah, they're in.
They're in.
Yeah.
And it's that's one of the stipulations. Plus, they've got this deal. It's called a intervention fee.
Mm-hmm.
So, anybody that's on probation or parole is required by probation and parole
mm-hmm.
to pay $30 a month to their fee program,
mm-hmm.
which is supposed to pay for, you know, anger management, substance abuse programs, good parenting classes, you know, whatever it may be.
Right. Whatever they've hit you with.
Right. Mm-hmm. But the money that you pay in,
mm-hmm.
you still have to pay for those classes.
Yeah.
Because in this town, they're private classes.
Mm-hmm.
There is no state classes in this area.
Yeah.
Without traveling, you know, 60 miles
yeah.
to go to one that's free.
Yeah.
So by the time you've wasted gas to go up there and go to this free class,
mm-hmm.
you're better off just paying them their 35 or 40 bucks a week
yeah.
and doing their class. So somebody else is making money,
uh-huh.
you know, and this private substance abuse program,
mm-hmm.
you know, is tied back to the judges
yeah.
and the attorneys because they're the ones who set it up.
Right.
You know, if I go in front of a judge for... Say I got caught with a joint,
mm-hmm.
okay, and I go to city court,
mm-hmm.
they're going to charge me a fine,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to put me on probation.
Yeah.
Okay, well, the probation office they send you to is not a state probation office.
It's a private.
It's a private probation office, which costs you more money
uh-huh.
every month, and more drug tests every month.
Right.
And then, you know, you've got, say, 2 years probation.
Mm-hmm.
You do fine. You get close to being done, and that's when they get you again.
These private companies that do counseling and they do all the different things that they do, of course, they're owned by somebody. And those are not just magic elves living in a tree somewhere trying to do good for the community. They're actually owned by people who want to make money. And there are investors in those companies. And it would be interesting to know who some of those investors are. If they're the same attorneys who are negotiating the plea bargains, and if they're the same attorneys that become judges that send people to those things. I know there was a case, a very famous case in Pennsylvania not long ago, where a judge was literally getting millions in kickbacks by sending kids into rehab programs for almost anything. You know, he was just any teenager that he got in front of him went into one of those programs, and he got a kickback for every single one of those. But that's, like, when that hits the news, you know, people think, oh, well, that's a one-off thing. That's weird. That just happened in that one place. But the fact is, in one way or another, a legal version of that is happening all over America. You were talking about investors in a specific organization like that who were all attorneys and so forth in the same area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's it's actually a company here in town. I don't know, should I mention it?
It doesn't matter.
Okay.
Well, I'm not afraid of them.
It's OCCS. it's a private
mm-hmm.
you know, corporation that you know, granted they've got jobs for five or six people, but
mm-hmm.
you know, an ironic thing about it is the city judge is secretary.
Mhm.
is now a probation officer at this probation firm.
Yeah.
And she runs this probation firm.
And probably everything they're doing is fully legal.
It probably is.
We're not assuming they're doing anything illegal.
Right.
Because we're assuming that the legal system itself is entirely corrupt.
Right. You know, and another thing about the probation and these classes that they make you take,
mm-hmm.
You know, being that it's middle America and working class and... You know, there's some cases that are, you know, extreme in every situation.
Right.
You know, but for the most part, you know, nobody's really wealthy,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's in these little groups.
Right.
You know, that's having to go through this. They're just working people that have families, that yeah. have bills, that have, you know, the trials and tribulations that normal people have.
Right.
You know, they've just got this on top of it.
Yeah.
Because of a mistake.
Yeah.
And say I go to three classes mm-hmm. at $30 a class.
Yeah.
Okay. Now I go back the next week and say my wife's lost her job.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Am I going to pay the $30 to this little substance abuse program?
Right.
Or am I going to put food on the table for yeah. my kids and pay yeah. rent and take care of my yeah. home?
You got to buy things like baby food and stuff. That's pretty important.
Yeah. But if you don't have the money to pay them,
yeah.
they drop you
mm-hmm.
from the class, and that gets sent
notification
over,
sent goes over
right over to your PO,
yep.
and then your PO is going to violate you,
yeah.
which puts you in a bigger situation than if... So it's... What's a person to do?
Yeah. I think the money thing is a thing that confuses a lot of people that are not really in this group of Americans. People, they're... You know, we were talking about this the other day. With a drunk driving conviction, you might get hit with a $2,000-$3,000 overall fines and everything. And some people are just like, well, they'll just pay that and everything's fine, you know? And other people, $2,000 to $3,000 out of your budget is crushing. It's life-changing. And a lot of times people who are earning in the higher earning brackets don't really understand that a fee of $2,000 or a fee of $35 a month, a $35 a month fee can be killer if you don't have $35 extra a month. You know, that can be murder. But people don't realize that. I know the judge doesn't realize that. He doesn't comprehend the price difference, you know. That a dollar means one thing to one person, but a dollar means a totally different thing to somebody else.
That it does.
I did a thing, an article back, I compared, like, if Bill Gates was walking into a coffee shop and he's going to pay $5 for a cup of coffee, and he's holding that $5 bill in his hand, that means nothing to Bill Gates. The coffee, a cup of coffee is worth more than $5 because he can be satisfied from it. He could throw a $100 bill in the air and never know he even did it, you know? But the guy on the street, the disabled veteran that's walking by on the street, who's straggling along and barely making it, there's no way he'd give $5 for a cup of coffee. It's like, you know, that is madness to him. That same $5 bill is a totally different object to him. And I think that's one of the disconnect there between this group of attorneys and judges and so forth. They disconnect their mind and they don't even look at the people under them as human when they make their godly judgment down upon these people. You know, they look at themselves as being, well, I'm proper, but all these here are, you know, subhuman in some way, and they don't even think about what the judgment that they're throwing down on them, what it means to them. Anyway, that maybe I'm judging judges wrong.
Well,
but that's
that's like when I got put on probation.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't ask anything about my financial situation
yeah.
at all.
Yeah.
You know, and that goes to prove the point of what you're just talking about, that, you know, a judge could care less
yeah.
about how much you make, whether you got a job, what you're doing in life.
Yeah.
He don't care.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, you did this,
mm-hmm.
but...
Also, you know, there used to be a concept of where the punishment met the crime, you know, but when the punishment never ends... When it's an endless cycle that you get stuck into, and it never ever ever ends, how is the punishment matching the crime? Well, first off, who was harmed? Let's go all the way back to the illegal weapon. When you purchased the gun, who was harmed there? Was there anybody who was hurt?
Well, probably the owner of the gun missing the gun.
Yeah, but you didn't steal it, right?
But I didn't steal it, but I paid for it.
Yeah,
I paid for it, and he got the gun back. So, I mean...
So you got hurt and the owner got hurt.
Right.
Essentially. So you didn't hurt anybody.
No.
And the owner of the gun got the gun back. So, technically speaking, it almost isn't the business of the government. I mean, I can see them working as an arbitrator to get the gun back to its original owner. But then to go ahead and drag the thing out for 5 years... in some kind of extended punishment of this. You know, there's, I don't see any justification. I don't see how an honest person can say, yeah, that sounds about right. 5 years of you know, constant having their eye on you for that one incident. You know, I don't see the connection there.
Because in that time, if I would have got pulled over for a traffic ticket,
yeah,
I would have to notify my PO. I mean, it's like I lost my freedom.
Yeah.
I lost every bit of it because everything that I did because of that one situation had greater consequences because of what happened.
Let's take it to a different situation that you had happen where your car was parked, keys weren't even in it, you were not in the car, and you got arrested separately from the car, and yet somehow that came out as like a drunk driving thing?
Yeah, okay. Here's the whole situation. Was at the bar.
Mm-hmm.
Me and a buddy was there. I was too drunk to drive.
Mm-hmm.
I drove there. He said he was fine to drive. Okay, here's my keys.
Mm-hmm.
He ends up wrecking my car. Okay. He was on parole.
Mm-hmm.
He took the keys out and made a beeline. And I start walking back to the bar where I know some people so I can go on home. Cop pulls up, arrests me, asks me to blow,
mm-hmm.
and I refuse.
Yeah.
Because they didn't pull me over driving.
Right. You're just walking.
But yet, when I refused to blow, I automatically lost my license for a year.
Mm.
Just as a refusal, period.
Yeah. Even though you weren't driving.
Even though I wasn't driving and no one see me driving.
Right.
Charged me with a DWI.
Mm-hmm.
And that was that. And then since that time, you know, I've been gone from that county, you know, like 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
Still on parole.
Yeah.
And now they're not letting me off parole because I haven't had any altercations or haven't been in trouble in over, you know, 4 years.
Yeah.
At all.
But now you're still looking.
But now they bring this case up and say, you have to take care of this case before you're off parole. And it's been 7 years, so I have no choice but to pay an attorney, mm-hmm. whatever the attorney wants.
Yeah.
You know, and he's out of town.
Mm-hmm.
They come back with a plea agreement for me of 2 years unsupervised probation.
Yeah.
A $600 fine, and I got to take a Mothers Against Drunk Driving class.
Mm. One of the most evil organizations in the United States today, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. My opinion purely, but I believe that to be true. I believe they are a leech, a bunch of do-gooders, busybodies, that live off of the blood of others. I think the original woman who set the thing up, I think she was sincere. But she, you know, she quit the organization and said that they are so far gone that she doesn't even want her name associated with them anymore. But again, so how can that possibly be justice? Now you're looking at this thing extending out even longer, even though that's been 7 years. You're still looking at years to come to have to deal with this.
Right. And you were talking about the layers of money. I don't mean to jump back, but another, you know, thing I want to mention is, like, I've done some jail time.
Mm-hmm.
I've done a little bit of time. When you get sentenced in this county,
mm-hmm.
to jail, for whatever it may be, you get charged $45 a day for every day you're in there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, it's one of those big fancy jails,
mm-hmm.
brand new. You know, you get bologna sandwiches at night.
Mm-hmm.
You don't even get three hot meals.
Yeah.
But at the end of your jail stay, when you leave, you're assessed your total fine of your jail bill. And that jail bill will stay there, and you've got an X amount of time to set up a payment plan or pay it off,
mm-hmm.
or you'll be right back in court. And what happens is, say, people less fortunate than me that couldn't pay their jail bill.
Yeah.
It would go on, and they would throw them back in jail,
mm-hmm.
for not paying their jail bill,
mm-hmm.
and give them $30 a day credit on top of their $45. So if you stay 10 days, that's $450. you would have to stay that many more days just to pay off for the 10 days that you were already in there.
So back in old ancient, well, not in ancient England, but back in like in the 1700s and stuff in England, they had a debtor's prison where they could throw you in prison for if you owed money. And that was outlawed. But yet, isn't that exactly what you just described?
It's exactly what it is.
You owe money, and so they put you in jail and continue charging you, you know, even though it's a loop you can't, there's no escape from it.
There's none.
Now, people on the outside, we were talking before about people on the outside can send you money, but then they take part of it? Is that?
Yeah, for this whole intervention fee.
Yeah.
That's $30 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to prison and you don't pay your intervention fee while you were out on parole or probation,
mm-hmm.
it'll rack up.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're in prison, which is, you know, just a wonderful place, you know, and your people can send you money, you know, so you can get tobacco and, you know, they've got commissary, but, you know, the most important thing is your cosmetics.
Yeah.
You know, your toothbrush, your toothpaste, deodorant, you know, foot powder, just basic essentials, Q-tips,
yeah,
you know, a comb,
yeah,
because they don't give you any of that,
right?
You know, when you go in,
and you're not allowed to take anything with you.
You're not allowed to take anything. So if you owe back fees for your intervention fees,
yeah,
they will tax all the money that's sent until that's paid off, and leave you $3.10 a month to buy cosmetics, which, you know, doesn't even, it'll buy a stick of deodorant,
yeah.
You know.
And you're buying it from them anyway.
Right.
I hear people like talk radio people, which I almost never listen to anymore, but I've tried listening to them at times, and it just makes me want to pull my hair out. But I've heard people on talk radio, and I've heard people on TV and stuff. I hear these people on TV talking about how luxurious the prisons are, and they talk about, well, they've got cable TV in there, and they've got, you know, they're eating turkey dinners, and they're... And I hear that, and I think there are probably prisons where that goes on. I mean, there are the so-called country club prisons where guys like, you know, the big investors from Wall Street and stuff, they go to these places that are called prisons. But that's not really what we're talking about here. That's not where rural America, middle America, the inner city people that are arrested, they don't go to the places like that, you know. What's more realistic of a view of life in there?
Well, like, you know, you've got Missouri, Texas, you know, Kansas. They've all got a fair number of prisons.
Mm-hmm.
I know in Missouri and Texas, you know, like 80% of them aren't air conditioned.
Mm-hmm.
So you're in a facility that's over 50, 60 years old.
Yeah.
That's basically behind the times.
Mm-hmm.
It was built in the big heyday in the 40s and 50s
mm-hmm.
when they didn't have air conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and they think everything is just, you know, oh, you go there and everything is just kicked back, you know, put your feet up, don't, you know, do anything.
Yeah.
You know, and in reality, it's not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's different levels of prison, and you know, each one of them is different.
Right. We're looking at a situation in the United States right now where there are a larger percentage of our population is in prison than in China. You know, a larger part of our population is in prison than in the old USSR when the USSR existed. When people in the USSR were being hauled away to work camps, you know, if you count up all those people that went off to the work camps proportioned to the population, we have more in the United States today. And the vast majority of those people in prison are not there because they murdered anybody or raped anybody or robbed anybody or anything like that. They're there for nonviolent crimes. They're there because a series of events took place and they got hit with a third strike and you're out from one of these stupid states that has third strike and you're out laws. And so they may have been carrying, you know, an ounce of marijuana or two joints of marijuana in some states. And that's the third strike, and now they're in jail, you know, and that's now their life. That's it. Doing this to our population, when you consider how many people are either in jail actively or in this system where they just keep milking you and milking you and pulling you in and letting you feel like you're going to escape. And then the moment you feel like, you know, I've got 6 months left of this probation, I'm going to be free, I'm never going to get into this again. And then something comes up and they've got you again. And it's not necessarily, it's like with the situation you were talking about there, it's not necessary. It's something you might have thought was already taken care of. And then they drag it back out of the woods and say, oh, yeah, but there was this one technicality. And so you're back on probation for another 5 years. And this just never stops. And if you just do the numbers in your mind and you think of how many people are either incarcerated for nonviolent crimes or on the street going through this process where they're constantly being milked every month for these different fees and having to go to these different programs and support this process, you're looking at a massive army of very angry people. This is not something that a nation can live very long with that many angry people in its belly, you know? I'm not trying to bait you into saying anything violent against the country, anything like that. I'm just ranting on my own here because I see this coming. I see so many people getting sick of this, and I see stuff going on in Europe, like, in London, they decided to raise the college fees a little bit for the kids, right? Because most of the college fees are all paid by the government, but now they're going to have to pay a little bit more. And that and a couple of police brutality situations, and the place erupts into, you know, they're burning buildings and stuff. And in Greece, they're like, well, the government's broke, so what we're going to have to do is cut back. They don't call it welfare, but that's what it is. We're going to have to cut back on our welfare a little bit, you know. And those people go nuts and start ripping the place apart. And the same thing in Spain. And we look at that in America, and we're like, oh, well, they're like that in Europe, but this will never happen in America. And I look at that, and I think, no, we're... When we break loose, when this happens in the United States, you've got this whole body of people that have been abused like this from this system. You get those people all moving in one direction at once. It's going to be scary.
Well, see, and the thing is, because they're in the system,
mm-hmm.
there is no voice,
mm-hmm.
there is no direction, there is no outspokenness because of the consequences, because they're already looped into the system. And if they were to speak out or... you know, control a movement or, mm-hmm. you know, right-wing activist style, you know, anything
yeah.
like that, and they're under the radar,
yeah.
you know, they're already in the system, they're hit, they're
yeah.
done.
Yep.
I mean, because the consequences will do nothing but stack up on them.
Yeah, yep. They it's built into the system to have them beaten to the point of where they know better than to do anything.
Yeah.
Pretty messed up situation.
You're talking about prisons and the vast overpopulation of prisons,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the Midwest,
mm-hmm.
just everybody that's on probation or parole or been sentenced to prison for, you know, petty crimes
mm-hmm.
that would never be sentenced in a bigger city. But because of the overpopulation of the prisons in the Midwest, they got this deal. It's an electronic tracking device. It's called house arrest.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so... you go to prison, you do your time,
mm-hmm.
you get paroled
yeah.
by the parole board,
mm-hmm.
and they send you home. They don't send you home free.
Right.
They send you home on house arrest, which is a device that's on your leg.
Mm-hmm.
There's a box that you set up in your home that's hooked to the phone cable
mm-hmm.
that sets a perimeter up around your house.
Yeah.
You're not allowed outside your front door or your back door
mm-hmm.
or however so many feet. It depends if you live in a big house or a small house.
Yeah.
Whether you can go outside or not.
Mm-hmm.
But so you've done all this time, and now you think you get to go to society,
mm-hmm.
but yet now you're on house arrest.
Yeah.
So your probation officer, you set up basically where you can go and when you can go kind of sheet.
Mm-hmm.
And they schedule you out so your box... you know, quits monitoring you, but it never really quits monitoring you.
Yeah.
It just won't go off if you break the line.
Within that time frame.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, to where you can go grocery shopping, where you can go, you know, to your classes,
mm-hmm.
you know, because that's something you got to do to work
mm-hmm.
if you're fortunate enough to find a job.
Yeah. If you can find a job where the employer will tolerate having a felon there with a thing on his leg.
Right.
because a lot of employers are not so happy about doing that.
Right. But that's also something that generates money.
Yeah.
Because you got to pay for that box too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, along with your $30 a month.
I'll bet there's a private monitoring company that handles that too.
I wonder
who the investors on those private monitoring companies are.
Well, and the thing is, like the Missouri Intervention Fund.
Oh yeah.
Is now it used to be that I could get a money order.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't send personal checks. You mm-hmm. can't send cash, so you got to go get a money order, which costs you, you know, $1.85 or $1.10 or whatever per money order.
Mm-hmm.
To pay for your intervention fee.
Yeah.
And you'd mail it in, you know, every 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
Now they've got it to where they've got a kiosk machine, which they only accept debit or credit cards.
Mm.
So when I went in to pay my intervention fee of $90 uh-huh. for my next 3 months,
yeah,
it cost me $92.50. You know, and I'm a type of person that I don't do banks.
Uh-huh.
I don't do banks. I don't do credit cards.
Right.
You know, if I've got the cash, I've got the cash.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'm able to either save it, or if I want something, I'll pay cash for it.
Right.
I don't like getting looped into payments, or, you know, what I've got is what I've got.
Right. Honest money.
Right. Yep. You know, it's bought and it's paid for. There it is.
Yeah.
So I had to give money
mm-hmm.
to a family member
mm-hmm.
to put on their card.
Yeah.
Because they no longer accept cashier's checks.
Now, I noticed an odd thing in the Walmart here that I didn't see in the Walmart where I live in Ohio. There's like a money station in Walmart, where you can go in there and you can get money cards, like debit cards with their Walmart money cards. You can cash checks. You can do all this kind of stuff. Where we're at in Ohio, where Cindy and I live in Ohio, it's more of the suburbs. There's a lot of McMansions around us. I don't know how to put it politely. We're in Yuppie City, USA, in there. You know, the Cincinnati-Dayton corridor. Now, Cincinnati is a rotted-out, rusted town, and Dayton is a rusted-out shell of a town. Some good people live in both places. That's not the point. But the infrastructure of these two towns are just, you know, they're 200-year-old rusted-out hulls of cities. But in between there is just track after track after track of, you know, upper middle class and even higher than that income McMansions and neighborhoods. So our Walmart doesn't have this money center like that. And when I was here and I spotted that money center, I knew immediately in my mind, because we had talked about this thing with the credit cards and the debit cards, I knew immediately in my mind why that's a marketable thing here and it's not in that part of Ohio. Because those people in that part of Ohio, they carry all their gold cards and their, you know, their platinum cards and all that all the time. But the working class people don't all have active bank accounts and use debit cards. A lot of them live in a cash society. And so when you get stuck into the system and you have to pay that, what was that that fund that we were talking about?
The intervention fee?
Yeah, that intervention fund. Is supported through debit and credit cards. So if you don't have a debit or credit card and you don't have a family member that will let you use theirs and pay them back for it, then you have to go to somebody like Walmart or some other people like this and buy one of those temporary cards that you have to keep refilling all the time. Well, you know, they make money off of those. And who is they? Well, they would be the bank that backs up, because Walmart's not a bank. You know, they're just the front organization for the bank that does that. So whoever the bank is that Walmart is doing that front for, that's the bank that actually makes the fees off of all those cards that are bought and sold and transferred. So then you go and you pay your intervention fee with that card, and there's another charge. And a bank gets that charge. It's the bank that handles the transaction. And then all that money goes into the state. No, it goes into a bank. And it's funny that when you start looking at the names of these banks, it's all the same banks. The same banks are holding that massive fund the same banks are charging the fees to put money into that fund, and the same banks are charging the fees to own the cards to put the money in the fund. And the money is just sitting there. And then when somebody needs to use out of that fund, I can't remember the process of how you said that that worked with the...
That all the money from... This is how it was supposed to work.
Uh-huh.
All the money from the intervention fee,
mm-hmm,
was supposed to pay for your anger management classes, your, you know, better parenting classes,
mm-hmm,
you know, things that would enable you to become a better member of society.
Right.
You know, to get you back in the swing of things and, mm-hmm, make you, you know, a better person.
Uh-huh.
You know, but then again, you turn around and you've got to pay for your classes.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, I've been on parole for, you know, 4 years,
mm-hmm,
and I've never once been to a program where I didn't have to pay.
Yeah.
But yet I paid $30 a month
into that fee
for 4 years. Yeah. So.
So it's sitting there growing and growing and growing. You have to wonder if all these different counseling organizations and all the tests, you think about how many people in the United States are having to be tested for substances on a regular basis. And every one of those tests has to be done by a medical person. They have to go through a lab. And somebody owns those labs. Some investors owns those labs. And much of the time, those are pharmaceutical companies that own those labs. And they're using the chemicals from the pharmaceutical company to do the testing on those. And the same investors in the pharmaceutical companies are the same ones that are, well, the pharmaceutical companies also provide the medication that the counseling people give out when they feel that you need help above and beyond just the counseling, so they're going to put you on medication. Or your children are disruptive in school because maybe their dad's having to work two jobs to pay for all the nonsense, doesn't get to spend time with him. So then rather than you having time to spend time with your child, what's the answer? The answer is to give your child drugs from the same pharmaceutical company that owns the lab, that tests the dad, that, you know, I mean, there's this giant loop, but at the top, you've got these same bankers holding the strings to the whole mess. And then who's invested into the bankers? Where do the judges and the attorneys just happen to be putting their money? And, you know, I don't have the capacity to put together a conspiracy of all these people doing all this on purpose. I'm not even sure if it is all on purpose. But I know one thing. I know all the money is going in one direction, and it's up. It's not coming back down, you know. All the money is going out of the hands of the people who need it the most and going into the hands of the people who already have almost all the money as it is. I'm going off on a rant again.
You know, I'd kind of be curious to know how many people are on probation or parole. I'll bet you the number is just huge. And then if you figure that hundreds of thousands of people,
mm-hmm, or millions
of people that are in this system,
yeah,
okay, over their 5-year plan,
mm-hmm,
times $30,
yeah,
a month.
Yeah.
The number would have is huge.
Yeah, it's a staggering amount of money. And you take that and multiply that by all the states this is going on in. And some are worse than others, you know. But imagine how much money is coming out of a place like the L.A. basin there with, you know, the different communities around L.A.
But see, something like this probably wouldn't happen out there.
I don't know.
Not to the extent that it happens here.
Yeah, I would say they probably, considering they have the gangs to pick on, they probably play the game a little bit differently, but I'll bet it's the same tune. You know, it's just a different, the words are different, maybe the charges are different, maybe the things that they pick them up for. I know, like, I think it was Philadelphia, they were doing curfew sweeps the same way. And they actually hit a high school, let's see, let me get that straight. No, it was a theater that was letting out high school age kids after the curfew, which was acceptable, you know, right along, and all of a sudden it becomes unacceptable. And so when the theater lets go of the kids at like 11:30 or something like that, kids that walk out, and normally you wait for a couple minutes and your parents pull up and pick you up, and they, you know, they were nailing the kids before the parents could get to them to the curb to pick them up. As soon as they're walking out of the theater, they're nailing them, hauling them down, you know, and now they're in the system. Broke curfew, you know. Well, they can't get you one way, they'll get you another way. As long as they can get you into the system. But anyway, so I don't know what the scam is in the inner cities, but I'm sure they have a, you know, they're working a different angle,
right,
to do the same thing to them. But
a nice little corrupt system.
It is. It absolutely is. I want to mention one other thing too, that, and this is just on my rant, the vivid difference that I see is the difference between, you know, what they call law, which is really just layers and layers and layers of rules that nobody really fully understands. That's what they call law, and that's what they will pick us out and punish us for if they choose to. I want to give a mention of a book. The book is called Three Felons a Day, and the premise of the book is that pretty much every average person who wakes up in the morning, gets up, gets dressed, has a cup of coffee, drives to work, you know, sits at their work and does whatever they do, takes a lunch break, eventually goes home, you know, takes a shower maybe, climbs into bed at night. That person on average has broken three felons every single day of their life because there are so many laws written, and the laws are so vague they can be translated in any way that a judge wants to translate them. And the author of that book makes the argument, and I think he does the argument very well. You should check that book out. I make no money from this book. I don't have like an Amazon link or anything. But check this book out. The laws are so vague that if they decide to pick on you, and it doesn't matter if you are, you know, any level in society's structure, if you come under their gun and they decide they want you, they can find at least three felonies a day that you have done because the laws are so vague and there's so many of them. And you might think, well, they can't possibly do that with me. Or the other thing, a lot of people will say, well, here's where I draw the line. They can do this and they can do that, but here's where I draw the line. Dude, they're past that line. You just don't even realize it. Alan, thanks for coming on the show with me.
Oh, thank you.
I appreciate your time. You didn't have to do this. You didn't get paid anything for it. You had no motivation to lie because, you know, the whole thing was anonymous here, so it's not like you had any reason to make anything up or lie. So, you know, we have, and not only that, I've known you for 33 years.
Yep.
So, I can say that, I know you're not lying. So, you know, folks listening, if you have any trust in any of the things that I've put on there or any of the things that I've written, then, you know, I'm giving you everything that I can give you as honestly as I can. And we're in trouble. We are seriously in trouble. And you know my solution for it. My solution is not to fight the state. They'll just kill you. They will. If you draw a weapon against the state on any level, they will kill you. What we have to do is we have to break free of this thing, and we have to deal privately using voluntary methods and alternative financing and stop supporting this thing. Figure out a way to not pay one nickel of tax if you can do it. If you can do it without drawing their attention, if you can do it legally, put yourself in a position where you don't pay one nickel of tax and just starve this thing to death. Thanks a lot for listening. Check back with us again at badquaker.com. Send me an email, ben@badquaker.com. Thanks a lot, folks.